We're going to finish up today our series in Luke called Deep Discipleship. We have moved through the Gospel of Luke since September together as part of our two-year deep and wide theme. And our classes, our sermons, our men's and women's groups that have met together have moved through the gospel in different ways, looked at it through different angles. And I really hope that our time in this gospel has, in fact, deepened our discipleship. As we've looked at different facets of what it means to follow Jesus. And so in this final sermon, Luke chapter 24, we find ourselves on the very first Easter Sunday. And on that morning, the followers of Jesus are in disarray because they believe their movement was probably at this point a flash in the pan, that it is over, that their leader has been killed, that hope is lost, and everything they have spent their time doing in the last 3 years has been for nothing. And so we find ourselves in this room as people talking, and they decide to send some people to the tomb. They're going to send Mary Magdalene, they're going to send Joanna and Mary to see what's going on. And they show up at the tomb. And they find, instead of the body of Jesus, they find two men there in gleaming clothes who say, "He's not here. He's risen." And so these women run back and report, "Of course, this is going to be great news." And the problem is, nobody believes them. But Peter has enough curiosity that he decides to go himself and see what's happened. He also finds the tomb empty, but he leaves wondering what's happened. He also doesn't draw a correct conclusion. So he comes back. So that's scene one, with everyone knowing the facts, but not quite understanding what's happened. And then we come to the second scene, which is the focus of our time today. Luke takes us to a dusty road leading from Jerusalem, the hub of all the action, out to Emmaus. It's about a 7-mile road, and we find two of Jesus' followers walking along that road out of town. They're talking to each other, and you have to wonder what their conversation must have been like. "Well, what do you think the Romans are going to do now? I'm glad we got out when we did. When will the real Messiah finally show up and get the Romans off our back? Are we still going to be under threat if we leave town?" Who knows what they were speaking about? While they're walking along the road, a third person shows up and starts walking with them. Now, we know who this is. Luke tells us who it is. But these followers of Jesus don't know who's just caught up with them. And this person, whom we know is Jesus, but they don't, says, "Hey, what are you guys talking about?" Just plays dumb here for a moment. And Cleopas, one of them, says, "You're coming the same direction we are. Do you not know what the number one trending topic is in Jerusalem right now? Where have you been? Well, we're talking about all the things that just happened." And Jesus says, "Oh, yep, what things?" And at this point, Cleopas begins to recite all the facts that have happened, and he gets it mostly correct. Here's what he says, Luke chapter 24, beginning in verse 19. Talking about Jesus, who he doesn't know he's talking to. He says, "Well, he was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it's the third day since all this took place." So far, exactly correct. It's almost as though he is reciting the Apostles' Creed at this point. Got all the facts in order. Here's the things we believe. But we get a glimpse at where they're headed with their conclusion when he says, "Well, we had hoped." Suggesting that despite all these facts, the outcome is not what they had wanted. He keeps going. He says, in addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but didn't find his body. They came and told us that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see Jesus. So still correct. Women went to the tomb. They saw the angels who said he's alive. Other companions verified it. They didn't see Jesus. And so at this point, we want to scream at these guys. Like, exactly, the tomb's empty. Therefore, he's risen. You're exactly there. Just get to the right conclusion. So summarizing what they say they know, Jesus was a prophet who had powerful words and actions. The chief priests handed him over. He was crucified. 3 days later, they find the tomb empty. The angels say he's alive. Other disciples verify this. They had 100% of the facts right, but the wrong conclusion. They believed Jesus up until the crucifixion, but that was for them a deal breaker. That moment, that event, they couldn't get past. And so whatever the facts led them to, they were precluded from coming to the right conclusion because, again, it was a deal breaker. It does not matter what the facts led up to. There's a business writer named Jeannie Duck, and she has a phrase that has stuck with me for a long time. She says, when people are unclear on everything, they will connect the dots in the most pathological way possible. And we've all had instances where we have done that. I remember several years ago, my family, we were in Fort Worth for a wedding of a family friend, and we were staying with my parents, my younger brother, who's 10 years younger. And so we were just out for the evening, and he'd gone off by himself, down to a bookstore or coffee shop, and he was just calling to say he was on his way back, just walking down the street, university in Fort Worth, and his phone went dead, or it hung up at least. And so everybody's freaking out. Somebody's grabbed him off the street. This is terrible. And I remember thinking, like, well, that doesn't immediately make your phone go dead. We would have heard something. Like, I think his battery just died. But you've had those instances where you can't reach somebody and you freak out. Even though there's 10 rational, calm possibilities, you jump to the worst one. Or maybe it's a parent or a boss or somebody in authority who just emails and texts you and says, hey, we need to talk. You like getting those? Give you a little confessional. Most ministers will say that if you email us and ask to meet, we would really love it if you would give us like one subject heading on what that's about. We always assume we're going to get chewed on a little bit. Sometimes that assumption is correct, according to some friends of mine. But we always, like, what could they possibly want? Oh, I did this wrong, and they're upset about that. They don't like this thing. And usually it's just, hey, I had a question about this one verse. Like, it's never as bad as you think it is. But sometimes we take little bits of information and we connect the dots wrongly and we come to the worst possible conclusion. That, I think, is what is happening with these followers of Jesus. They've connected the dots and they've come to the conclusion that their movement was all for nothing. The psalmists are in this ballpark too. Some of the lament psalmists, as you know, the lament psalms where people are crying out to God for help, are between a third and a half of the psalms, depending on how you categorize them. And these psalms do some similar things. They will list some correct facts, and that the conclusion they draw is understandable but incorrect. So whoever is writing Psalm 22 says, I'm scorned and despised. People are mocking and insulting me. Enemies are surrounding me. My bones are out of joint. My heart has melted. And the conclusion this psalmist draws based on those facts is this: my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me? You're so far from my cries of anguish. So based on the facts, I'm scorned, the enemies are around me, my bones are out of joint, this psalmist draws the conclusion that God has forsaken me. and he won't save me. He is, in fact, unreachable. Or Psalm 88, probably the bleakest psalm we have. Here are the facts, the psalmist says. I'm overwhelmed with troubles and almost dead. I'm in the pit. I have no more friends. There's no escape. And I'm full of grief. Some of you know what it's like to feel that way. The conclusion this psalmist draws is this. Why, Lord, do you reject me and hide your face from me? You have taken from me friend and neighbor. Darkness is my closest friend. So the conclusion this psalmist draws is that God has rejected and hidden himself, and that God took all his relationships away. You too can list some facts. My diagnosis is overwhelming. Death is near for me or someone I love, and there's nothing I can do about it. My relationships are crumbling. My mental health is spiraling. World leaders are terrible. And like these psalmists, you could draw some conclusions. You could say, God has abandoned me. He's abandoned us. You could say, God has turned his face and he doesn't care. You could say that God just is up there with his hands in his pockets, looking around but doing nothing because he doesn't care. So what do we do when we list all of our facts and we come up with these kinds of bleak conclusions? We go back to this road to Emmaus, and Jesus begins to chastise those who listed the facts and came to the wrong conclusions. And Jesus said, you know, if you just paid attention to the prophets and the law, all of this pointed to me and said this had to happen and said I would be raised. You are ignorant and you should know better. And he's right about that. But even that doesn't change their minds. That is not even the final fix. The final fix comes down in verse 30. When he's in a home somewhere in Emmaus, and Luke tells us this. When he was at the table with them, this is Jesus with those followers, he took bread, he gave thanks, he broke it, and he began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us? Then they got up and returned to Jerusalem. There they found the 11 and those with them assembled together and saying, it is true. The Lord has risen and appeared to Simon. I want you to recall the verbs Luke tells us that Jesus does here. He takes, he blesses, let's give thanks, he breaks it, and then he gives it. That is the exact same sequence of verbs that Luke tells us Jesus does when he feeds the 5,000. It's the exact same sequence of verbs at Passover when Jesus meets with his disciples for the final time before he's crucified. He meets with them and he takes, he blesses, he breaks and gives. It's the last thing he does before he dies, and it's the first thing he does with them after he's risen. That is the liturgy of the table of the Lord. That is when their eyes were opened and they recognized him. Not when he listed all the facts, not when he pointed them to teachings, but when he takes and blesses and breaks and gives. Aristotle calls this kind of thing a recognition scene where nothing really changes, but all of a sudden you get it. So they're in the room together, same people, but because of the actions, they see differently and finally understand what's happening. It's not one more sermon, it's not one more article, one more podcast, not one more reel that will get them to the right conclusion. That's not what gets us there. What got them there is that they broke bread together at the table, and there they were reminded of the deep, steadfast presence of Jesus and of all the promises fulfilled, and they were reminded that their hope was, in fact, not in vain. And I suspect that many of us in here find ourselves like those on the road to Emmaus, because we can list all the facts. My disease is growing. My loved one is dying. My relationships are in trouble. My mental health is spiraling. Things are bad in my life. And what you don't need, and I recognize the irony of me saying this at this point, what you don't need is one more sermon and one more self-help book and one more inspirational quote. Those things can be helpful, I know. But perhaps what you need is to join the church at the table of the Lord and be reminded of his presence and be reminded that your hope is not in vain. Because when everything in your life is chaos, what you have is the steady presence of the weekly table. When your disease is growing, when your loved one is dying, when your health, when your mental health is spiraling, when your relationships are crumbling, maybe the only thing you have that's steady is this weekly gathering at the table. Maybe that's the one thing you can hold on to, where Jesus shows up faithfully and where you can see him. And so, church, at this time, what I'd like to do is to invite you to the table of the Lord.